I have 9 o'clock, so let us begin. We will finish today with Rav Eliyahu ben Amozig. I want to be sure that I finish, so I'm not going to be spending some time at the beginning here dealing with some interesting questions and comments. Just deal with two things that relate directly to what we've been doing, and also one that doesn't relate, but I can't resist. The one that doesn't relate, if you recall last semester, I showed a video of this so-called Kabbalist, and I put that in quotes, doing an exorcism or an attempted exorcism of a dibbuk, first doing it from over Skype and then in person. This same so-called Kabbalist tried this stunt about 5 years ago with a woman who had a dibbuk inside of her, and this woman later gave an interview explaining how it was all a fraud. It turns out now that this whole business with the dibbuk, which thousands, something which, I mean, would have been unimaginable in the Ashkenazic world, not the Hasidic world, I'm saying, but in the non-Hasidic world years ago. You all saw the videos, thousands of people, and lo and behold, it comes out last week, as we could have expected, that it was a fraud. I don't know what else to say other than we live in very strange times, and I'm not saying that these Kabbalists are charlatans in the sense that they're trying to take people's money, but they clearly are hardly sophisticated and really making a mockery of our religion. And when you compare these guys to the real Mekubalim, the one we're looking at right now in the picture, Rav Eliyahu ben Amozig, even Yaakov Emden, who was a great Mekubal, and others, and the fact that the so-called Gedolim of our day basically go along with all this stuff, it shows you what sort of era we're living in. So if you haven't heard the news, just look it up and you'll see. So now this so-called Kabbalist is struck out twice, both times with his exorcisms. I don't know what he could do now. If you read the Times last weekend, the Catholic Church is now putting a new stress on exorcisms. So I guess you can go to the Catholic Church and try your tactic there, because real Mekubalim, like Rabbi Ben Amozig and others, were never taken in by this. And I'm sorry to say that Rabbi Moshe Sternbach is the only one of the sages in the land of Israel who immediately declared that this is a fraud, this guy needs to go to a psychiatrist. Apparently he didn't need a psychiatrist. Apparently the whole thing was a fake to begin with. He learned foreign languages. But I couldn't resist passing that bit of news on. Just two quick things before we begin. One of you asked, we were talking last class about Ben Amozig's notion that certain mitzvot that we have are continuations of what were the general practices. And one of you asked, and doesn't this sound a lot like the Rambam? And of course it does. You all know the Rambam's view of sacrifices, that this was an earlier practice that continues. Although I have to say that Ben Amozig is very upset with the Rambam's view of sacrifices, and he criticizes very sharply. But that's not the only thing the Rambam says it about. If you look, for example, in Guide Volume 3, Chapter 49, he speaks about Yibum. He says the whole reason for the levirate is that this was an ancient custom that obtained before the giving of the Torah. And the whole business with Chalitza, this all were pre-Mosaic practices that the Torah continues. Course, using it for its own purposes. So thank you for that comment. And finally, I just want to thank Kami, who I think is listening now, who was listening last week, for pointing out an error I made. I misspoke. I mean, I have certain notes written here, but about 80% of what I say is extemporaneous. So sometimes I'll misspeak. I said, the first thing I said was that the sun was created on the third day. Not true. It was created on the fourth day. Thanks for reminding me of that. And I also mentioned that Malki Tzedek was a pagan priest. And so while Kami asked about that, truthfully, I wasn't careful in my words, but it's a question of how you define the word pagan. There's two definitions for it. One is anyone who's not Jewish, Christian, or Muslim. And that was the definition I'm using, but that's not the general definition, so you shouldn't use that. The general definition is someone who's a polytheist, and under that definition, which is the mainstream definition, Malki Tzedek was not a polytheist. On the contrary, Ben Amozig speaks about how he was the worshiper, and you find this in the rabbinic literature, of the one God. And in his book, Israel Humanity, he points out how the city he was in, Shalem, is identical with Jerusalem, and here we pick as our holy site the city. Well, let me read it to you. You get a sense of where he's coming from. After saying that, he says, "Is it not remarkable that the center for our worship of the true God was established at Jerusalem, formerly the site of the religion of Melchizedek? The choice of that city to be Israel's religious and political metropolis, the establishment of Jewish monotheism in a place that had previously been consecrated by the worship of Gentiles, and without any resentment on the part of Moses." And then he goes on in the others, "We have here a significant argument in favor of Jewish universalism." So here you have that Melchizedek worshipped the one God. And there's no problem with us adopting the city that he used to continue this. Okay. Let us move on. I ended last class, if you recall, pointing out that there's this Haredi group in Jerusalem that came out with this volume. They see it as an anti-missionary tract, which is not at all. It's simply a tract trying to show that Jewish views of ethics are at least the equal, but he says superior, to Christian ethics. And a good portion of this book is to try to show you that any time any positive or valuable statement in the Gospels, ethical statement, you can find parallels in Jewish sources. I think I mentioned the phrase, "Mashachadosh eino chidush." "Mashachidush eino chadash." What they think is new, is a novelty, is not new, and "Mashachadosh eino tov." And what's really new is not good. That's basically his approach in this book. So if you see a book that tries to show the superiority of Judaism as an anti-missionary tract, fine. But it's not, when we speak of anti-missionary tracts, we mean books that try to disprove the truth of Christianity. He doesn't try to do that at all. And I mentioned that when I was reading it, lo and behold, I start seeing different fonts on certain pages. So I go to Google Books, and wouldn't you know it, they've censored the book. Now you can, I personally find it extremely disrespectful. You have a book, you think it's a valuable book, print the book. There's an expression in the Talmud, a generation that judges its judges. So they choose to determine what the Ben HaMozig is worthy of appearing and what's not. I don't think that's proper at all. But what they did choose to censor, I can't get into all of it now, but I'll point out one thing, is quite fascinating. On page 105 in this book, states that Rabbi Shimon was from the sect of the Essenes. So he says, he gives us a synonym for this, the early Kabbalists, early Mekubalim. And then he says it about Nehorai. So what's going on here? Two of our great sages, he's identifying with the Essenes. Now, he has a whole book on the Essenes in Italian. Now, it's not available online, so I can't check it. But I get a sense of what he's dealing with, what he's talking about, because also Zaini deals with it. He has this notion that the early Essenes were Mekubalim, and they were part of mainstream Judaism, just a Kabbalistic sect. And Zaini doesn't note that in his commentary on Chumash, in his commentary on Vayikra, turn to Perechaf Dalid. You can get this online now. It's on HebrewBooks.org. Pasuk 15, Tet Vav. He says it explicitly here that he refers to the Essenes, and he says that he believes that the Essenes were the first of the Mekubalim, that is, those who were recipients of the secret teaching, and quote from Josephus and Philo, etc. Now, in this book, in this book on Jewish and Christian ethics, on page 86, he does something also very interesting. He speaks of Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha. This has always been a big thing for Christians. They like to stress the fact that in their religion, the golden rule is do unto others. It's positive. And in our religion, we have what Hillel says, don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself, and say that positive phraseology is better than a negative phraseology, and therefore Jesus' teaching is superior. Truthfully, we have the positive formulation also. If you look in the Targum, it has a positive formulation, and Jesus is just, as in all these cases, simply reflecting a traditional Jewish perspective. Our Kitvei Kodesh, our Jewish sources, rabbinic sources, have the positive and the negative. So he's talking all about the Haftarecha Kamocha, and he says that it applies to non-Jews also. Love thy neighbor as thyself, not the wicked non-Jews, not killers, nothing like that, but the typical non-Jew who's a good person, the Haftarecha Kamocha applies. Now, Rabbi Zaini, who I spoke about, he's the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hezdi Yeshiva in Haifa, who is the translator now of Ben Amozik's French writings, a big Talmud Chacham, has written an enormous amount, very much on the right wing of Israeli politics, and he's not a kachnik, but he's very much to the right. It's hard to see what he finds so attractive in Ben Amozik. It's not this aspect, I can tell you that. On page 189 in his book here, I just have to say he is outraged. I don't think that's too strong a terminology. Here's an example of the page. I don't know if you can see it. His notes criticizing, getting very upset with what he sees and as an outrageous position to say that the Haftarecha Kamocha applies to non-Jews. Now, he also thinks that, and he goes on a whole page talking about this, he thinks that perhaps Ben Amozik has a strategy in this book, an apologetic strategy, that if you can find any position, even if it's rejected from halacha, it's okay to advocate it because it's good for your argument. And also he says, that if you can find passages that, not that we accept it, but the hints of an idea, even though these are not the accepted idea, not that this is not accepted halakhically, but these are just basic ideas that you can sort of find, like, ideas pointing to, like someone raises achiza kara, he says, something like that. You know, just a small hint of something, then he's able to say this. In other words, he thinks that Ben Amozig, in his vernacular writings, is engaging in apologetics, and he knows that the Haftarecha Kamocha doesn't apply to non-Jews. And yet, what Zaini does not mention, does not point out, I can't imagine why he doesn't. He must have this book. If any one of you know him, you can ask him. Here is Ben Amozik's Perush to Vayikra. On the verse, you see at the top, the Haftarecha Kamocha. This is a book without any apologetic tendencies, directed only to Jews, written in the Hebrew language, and see, right here, it says, bring up my green piece of, it says, Mima, it says right here, from the fact that it says, the Haftarecha Kamocha, we see that Reacha Kol Min HaAdam means any person. And then it goes on and explains how that fits into the verse, and then he proves it, because later on, in this chapter, it speaks about you shall love the ger, the stranger that lives among you, ve'haftalo kamocha, because you were gerim in Mitzrayim. And it's not referring to a ger tzedek there. It's referring to just a general non-Jew who lives among you. Without getting into the exegesis here, it's obvious that according to Ben Amozig, ve'haftalo kamocha applies to all non-Jews. Now, by the way, the Sefer HaBrit says the same thing. Sefer HaBrit is a 19th century work. And I also found, I looked in the Torah Shlema, under the Pasuk, and Torah Shlema quotes Avos Rabbi Nassim. So the standard view is that it's Reacha, that is your neighbor in mitzvot, that is, it does refer to Jews. And you can explain this in all sorts of ways. It's enough, I would say, it's enough not to be negative to others, but to actually have love for the other. You can't expect everyone to love the whole world. It's hard enough to love your fellow Jew. And I don't think anyone can begrudge us of that. Or you could say, what does it mean to love? I mean, love is an interesting thing. I think you can pull up the source comedy. Thank you very much. Love is an interesting thing because love in the Bible is not really what we think of as love. You have to ask Hashem al kecha. What does it mean to love God? The Rambam says love is knowledge of God. I mean, it's not romantic love, obviously. So how can you love God? How can you love a being you don't even understand? We can't know anything about God. We can only know his actions. So for the Rambam, love there means intellectual love, which means knowledge. The mystics, of course, they speak in terms of real love. But leaving aside mysticism, what does love mean? Lots of words are not clear in it. Amuna. Amuna means faith, right? But if you look in the Torah, in the scriptures, amuna doesn't mean faith the way you think. It doesn't mean faith at all. It means that is faith in doctrines. It means faith that is, it doesn't mean belief in doctrines. It means to be faithful. So when you speak about someone who's in the Bible, amuna, it means he is faithful to God. He's a follower of God, not that he believes in certain presuppositions or anything else. So what about ahava? We actually have ancient Near Eastern texts that speak, for example, one speaks of you shall love Asurbanipal as yourself. Your father's paid tribute to him, you shall pay tribute. So love there means loyalty. And the Torah is written at the very same time as this Near Eastern document and others like it. And if you assume, as Ben Amozik does, that you can illuminate meanings in the Torah by other Near Eastern documents, love means loyalty. Follow, you obey. So love could mean, that could be the meaning of love. You have loyalty, as in friendship. Or love could simply mean, don't do to others what you don't want done to you. In any event, there's lots of different meanings for love. But if you look into our Shlema sites, Pavel Strabi Nassan, in commenting on V'hafter Acha Kamocha, understands it as Sinat Habriyot. That is the opposite of Sinat Habriyot. He's talking about Sinat Habriyot, and then as the opposite, it says V'hafter Acha Kamocha. Well, Sinat Habriyot, it's hard to see this as only when you use words like, you say, what is Sinat Habriyot? It means that you shouldn't say only love the sages and hate your students, etc., or only love the students and hate the masses. And then it says, but you shall love them all, and it says, v'hafter acha kamocha. But the phrase, habriyot, it could just refer to Jews, but it usually has a connotation, a much wider connotation. In any event, Ben Amozik says that in this notion that we love everyone, even the idolater, he says, he's not referring to the one so to say who persecute Jews, but the idolater, he says, this is what the Mekubalim teach. So Zaini gets outraged by this. He says, this, I mean, and he's the big chassid of Ben Amozik, but he's a critical chassid. He says, this is a terrible approach. First of all, he says, this is the approach of the people today who want to be nice to all the terrorists and don't punish them and want to release them and all this, which is nonsense, what he's saying. Because Ben Amozik is not referring to terrorists or anything like this. He's referring to your typical non-Jew who's a good person. But then he goes on, and he calls it actually a catastrophe has come about by people who have this notion that you have to love everyone. I'm not going to go through everything he mentions here, but then he gets into the who are these Mekubalim? Well, Rav Chaim Vital, leading student to the Ari, who's a canonical figure in Kabbalah. He is the one that says you should love everyone, even the idolater. And Rav Kook actually quotes this. So what does Zaini then do with this? Because how can you criticize Ben Amozik so much when it's Rav Chaim Vital who says this? Well, Ben Amozik has Zaini has the answer. He says, this is referring to Rak Kadosh Ve'Elyon, HaMukshar Ruach HaKodesh, O Nevuah, Tzarech Liyot Malei Ahava Kazo, Shehu Kvar Ohev Kol Bnei Amo Ki'atzmo. He goes on and on. He says, Rav Chaim Vital is speaking about someone who already loves as much as possible the Jewish people, and he still has more room in his soul for love. So he should love the others, the non-Jews. But the average person, not just the average person, almost everyone else, they have a hard enough time loving all the Jews. So to tell them they're supposed to love non-Jews. So in other words, he's saying that this passage that Ben Amozik is citing is a general rule that you try to love everyone. this is only referring to the Chassidei Tzaddikei Olam, the Yechidei Sgula, but us average people, not only is this not something we can do, this is not something we should strive for. And he says, I mean, this language is unbelievable, but and maybe he's right, but you got to hear this. Katastrophia Gedola, Samchal Anu Mipirsum Divrei Rafayim Vital Eila. This is, after Rav Kook quotes this, others started quoting, he says it's a catastrophe that people know this, because now they're so interested in being, as you'd say, social justice type of Jews, instead of focusing on the Jewish people. But, he's so upset with Ben HaMozik. Ben HaMozik is simply slighting the Chaim Vital. One more thing I'll point out to you. In this, I think it's very interesting, in this passage that I cited, Ve'ahavta Re'acha Kamocha, let me pull it up again. This is in chapter 19 in Leviticus. I think this is one of the great chapters because you all know how Christianity, they rejected the ritual law. They don't reject the moral law. They're still bound by the Ten Commandments and things like that. However, the ritual law, don't tattoo yourself, for example, from this chapter. That doesn't bind them. Shaving with a razor, kosher food, all the things that make Jews Jews, don't bind them. And yet, if you look in chapter 19 of Vayikra, no distinction is made between what we would regard as the ethical laws, love thy neighbor, just weights and measures, and the totally ritualistic laws. And then Moses points this out in the Perish that I just, right down here, he says how wondrous it is that right after Ve'ahavta Re'acha Kamocha comes laws about kilayim and things like that. He actually calls them, for some reason, if you look at the down here, he calls them those halah shabbat mitzvot, he calls them more of light commandments. I'm not sure why they're light commandments, just maybe easy to fulfill. But he stresses the fact that you have here the greatest rejection, really, of this idea that you can distinguish between two types of mitzvot, that back-to-back psukim, and it's not just here, it's the whole perek. There's a joining together of the, take a look at the chapter later, of the ethical and the moral together with the completely ritual without any distinction made. And then he writes, they're kuan shavim, lifnei chachmaso, yisbarach, these are all equal in God's eyes. And they were all given at, they're all given together and et cetera, et cetera. And that really is what Judaism is all about, right? We're not Reformed Jews. We're not even conservative Jews. We're not Christians. We don't, start distinguishing between the important mitzvot and non-important, the ones that are, transitory and the ones that are everlasting. All the mitzvot are given together. In this chapter, Leviticus 19, you see very clearly that we don't make these distinctions, that, and that's what Ben HaMozik's point is. They're all given together, tied up with one another. So it's a wonderful comment of his. Right after, you've seen the Torah, take it back, v'hatar ha'chamocha, v'hempcha v'otav yekilayim. So these two are compared. In Yitron lazo alzo. Although he calls one light, he says that the mitzvot shimiyot, that is the laws that we just don't really have the apparent reasons, like kivayim, he calls this one of the lighter ones. But one has no advantage over the other. This language of a light mitzvah and a hard mitzvah actually goes back to the Rambam. Rambam speaks about difficult mitzvahs and easy mitzvahs. So I think what Ben HaMozik says is that he compares the Ve'ahavta Re'acha Kamocha, which is so hard to do. It's hard, let's be honest, especially your neighbor, your friend that you like, it's easy, but what about the one you don't like? But it's very easy not to do kilayim. That's what it is. Because when the Rambam speaks about an easy mitzvah, he says an easy mitzvah is speaking Hebrew. Hebrew is a mitzvah to speak Hebrew. So he says that's an easy mitzvah. But from the standpoint of the Torah, they're right together. They don't have any advantage. Finally, just one more comment from Zaini before we go on. Page 191. Basically, this comment actually annoyed me. that Ben Amozig is talking about the value of the Noahide, how important Noahide is, and he cites Rambam's view and standard view that the Hasidim, that the righteous of the nations have a share in the world to come. So Zaini, who's a real particularist, which is why I don't know what why he's a chassid at all of Ben Amozig, he has to comment here that while it's true that the Gentile has a share in the world to come, no rabbi in history, including Ben Amozig, he just assumes this, but there's no otherwise. In fact, it seems just the opposite. No rabbi in history ever said that the non-Jew gets oto chelek. Shayehudi Yiskelo. He says, yes, the non-Jew can get a share in the world to come, but not the same share as the Jew. So how does he explain Ben Amozig that speaks about how a non-Jew, if he follows his laws, is equal in God's eyes? It's just he's doing his task and the Jews are doing their task. He says, Ben Amozig wrote this way, either mitochos as he wrote, either he wasn't careful in his writing. He got so excited and so enraptured by his idea of the Noahide that he writes that the Noahide and the Jew can reach the same place in Olam Haba. Truth is, that's, I think, although it's maybe not the view of Rabbi Zaini and others, that seems to be the view of the Rambam and everyone else who deals with it. Though it's... Jew could perhaps understand and reach higher levels, but in general, there's no reason to assume that a typical Jew and a typical non-Jew won't be at the same level. I mean, I don't know. I'm not up there, but I don't know why you need to make that assumption. Jews are not Jews because they want to get Olam Haba. The great zechus is the fact that our mitzvah, that we can observe Torah mitzvahs in this lifetime. That is reward enough. Whatever happens afterwards, whatever Hashem gives us, that's what He gives us. So particularistic. It's enough that we have a Torah in this lifetime that we need to now start talking about how in the next world we're still going to be separate and different, and I don't know, that's just my sentiment. Ben Amozig dies. Now let's pick up the story again. He, all this great writing, he passes away in the year 1900 at the age of 78. I now want to talk a bit about his great student, Pallier. I'm the Pallier. Author of this book. You can get very cheap used books, The Unknown Sanctuary, A Pilgrimage from Rome to Israel. Pallier is the first, as far as I know, the first Noahide in history. That is, the first person who lives as a Noahide consciously. There's plenty of people, non-Jews, who've lived and followed the Shev Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, but I'm talking about someone who follows them consciously because they are given as part of the Torah to Moses. How many of those do you have? Today you might have a few, but I don't know of any for Pallier. This is a spiritual autobiography. If people like spiritual autobiographies, you'll find it very interesting. He wants to convert to Judaism. What Noahide does, what non-Jew who discovers Judaism does not want to convert? That's the normal way, as I mentioned already. However, he is convinced by Ben Amozig that he will do more for the world. Remember, Ben Amozig has this conception of Noahidism, and now you have a non-Jew coming to him who is willing to assume this role of spreading the word. It's one thing when Ben Amozig writes about this, it's all theoretical. But now you can practically begin the process of spreading the Noahide ideology. Ben Amozig convinces him to remain not Jewish as a Noahide and spread the word. Preach to the non-Jewish world. So truth be told, Ben Amozig also preached to the Jews. In fact, his last article, published in 1949, right before his death, is an article directed to Jews about the importance of Shabbos. Pallier is very upset that most Jews don't recognize the value of Shabbos. So here you have a non-Jew writing to Jews about how important Shabbos is. Pallier was actually the president of the Universal Union of Jewish Youth, which was called the Universal Union. It was really a French organization, and it was a Zionist organization. So here you have a non-Jew who's the head of the French Youth Zionist organization. A philo Semite. When I was in college, junior year, sophomore year actually, UJA identified people on campus that they wanted to take to Israel. I was one of the representatives from Brandeis. There were two of us. And lo and behold, from one of the, we had someone, very few of us were Shomer Shabbos or anything, but they were all Jewish, except for one guy from this Midwestern college, a non-Jew, who on his campus out in the Midwest raised money. He started a UJA fundraising drive and raised money for UJA among the non-Jews in his campus. And he wasn't an evangelical or anything like that. Pretty amazing, if you ask me. That's another example of a final Semite. Hallier was also on the board of the French chapter of Keren Kayamet. If there's ever a non-Jew who was on that, one of his goals, we know about his major goal, bringing Noahide understanding to the non-Jews, but one of his goals was also to bring Judaism to the Jewish people. Hard to see how this could work. I mean, that non-Jews are going to pay attention to what a Jew, I mean, Jews are going to pay attention to what a non-Jew is telling them, but maybe a non-Jew tells them how important Shabbos is and how significant it is, that they'll take it more seriously than if ultra-Orthodox person who are a Haredi or a modern Orthodox or anyone else tells them that they don't like. But if a non-Jew sees its significance, maybe it'll be more valuable. Hallier writes how the Jews have forgotten that they are the chosen people. Hallier is more Zionist than most Jews. We have that phenomenon today, Sarah Palin and the rest, but that's Hallier. Now, although he is the Talmud Muvak, great student, only met him one time. He is mostly a student through correspondence. One time, he tells the whole story there, how he walked into a shul once, I believe it was in Nice. He's very interested in Judaism, and someone tells him there, you know, France is very close to Italy, that there's a great rabbi in Livorno, his name is Ben Amozig, you should go see him. So Ben Amozig sets out on a journey, but he gets there, Ben Amozig's ill, and he can't go to shul. He leaves a note for him, and this starts then a correspondence, and then he later returns and spends quality time with him. But for the rest of Ben Amozig's life, they have a correspondence, and Ben Amozig becomes his teacher. The book is valuable, in addition to just his own story, because you have letters, which he reprints from Ben Amozig. Some incredible things he has in here. I'll just read you some of one of the letters he received from him. This is Ben Amozig writing to Hallier, explaining to him the Jewish notion of what it means to be a Noahide, how Jews regard the rest of the world. We Jews have in our keeping the religion destined for the entire human race, the only religion to which the Gentiles shall be subject and by which they are to be saved truly by the grace of God, as were our patriarchs before the law. In other words, the world today, the world of non-Jews, are equal to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They lived before the Torah was given, and yet they followed the moral law, the basic Torah wisdom, certain practices. They abstained from others, the seven laws of Noah. Listen to this. And then that's how the non-Jews should live. Could you suppose that the true religion, that which God destines for all humanity, dates only from Moses and carries the impulse of a special people? He's saying, is it possible to imagine that the only true religion is the religion of the Jewish people dating from Moses? No, there has to be a universal true religion for the world as a whole. What an error! Learn that the plan of God is vaster. The religion of humanity is no other than Noahism. Not that it was instituted by Noah, but because it dates from the covenant made by God with humanity in the person of this just man. Here is the religion preserved by Israel to be transmitted to the Gentiles. Our job is to transmit this Noahide religion to the Gentiles. This is the Lubavitch Rebbe got on this in the 1980s. And then he says to him, this is the path which lies open before your efforts, for mine as well, to spread the knowledge thereof, and it is my duty to do so. And he goes on, I invite you to turn your thoughts toward that which existed before the thought had come to Peter to impose the Mosaic law upon the Gentiles, and to Paul to exempt the Jews themselves from this law. He says, I want you to return to that ancient principle, Mosaism for the Jews and for those strangers who live in the land. Turn there to the Ger Toshav. and the who had certain commandments, and the religion of the patriarchs for the Gentiles. In other words, the non-Jews are supposed to follow the religion of the patriarchs. Actually, no, he's not referring to Gert Joseph here. He's saying those strangers to Israel on birth, who, he's talking about people who want to convert. He says, as this is the religion whose triumph the patriarchs foretold from Messianic times. Always spoken about that the religion of humanity is the religion of the Noahide religion. And he goes on. What about Jesus? This is what he tells him about Jesus. I tell you, because it is important, and because possibly this question is the most legitimately at the bottom of your thoughts. Aliyeh had grown up a Christian. He had studied to be a priest. What do you do about Jesus? I had a student who came to me, dating a Jewish guy. This just happened 2 weeks ago. I had no idea she was dating a Jewish guy. And she wants her future mother-in-law, maybe, doesn't want her, you know, wants Jewish grandchildren. She wants to know, maybe, about converting. I mean, it's really a non-starter, I think, because the person, her boyfriend's not at all religious. But in any event, I said to her as follows. I said, even before you begin thinking about conversion, answer me honestly. Do you think Jesus is a complete fraud? I said, not in an ethical sense. I said, do you think that there's any possibility at all that Jesus is God incarnate? And if you believe that this is a complete fraud, the notion that Jesus is God, then maybe we can talk. But if in the back of your mind, or even in the front of your mind, you still have this conception that Jesus is, there's something significant about Jesus, then we can't even begin to talk. And she acknowledged that she does have ties to Jesus. And so it didn't go very far. She says about Jesus. He says, on condition that divinity be not attributed to him, there would be no reason whatsoever not to make of him a prophet, to consider him a man charged by God with an august religious mission, without because of this altering any part of the ancient word of God, and without abolishing for the Jewish law, as his disciples pretended to do, thus misrepresenting his explicit teachings. He cites the book of Matthew, which says, Jesus says, I've come to fulfill the law, not to violate it. In other words, he's telling Palier, if you want to still think of Jesus, who you up with, as a great teacher, as a prophet, in the sense that he's come to teach non-Jews to follow the Noahide laws. I don't think he's referring to prophet in the sense that God actually has he had a vision, but a prophet that he's teaching the proper teachings. That's fine. That's a positive thing. What he's saying basically is the exact same thing Rav Yaakov Emden said. I don't know if he knew Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden believes that Jesus is a positive figure coming to the non-Jews, and that we have no ill will towards him, but it's Paul who screwed it all up, who turned Christianity into a religion also looking for Jews to give up the law. But before that, you had a notion that Jews keep their law, even if they listen to Jesus, and the non-Jews do their thing. They follow the Noahide laws. And also later on, you have the idea of Jesus as a divinity. So Ben Moses is saying to him, take Jesus' moral teachings. Be inspired by them, but no divinity, none of that. If it was not for our difficult history. Let me give you a good example. I could get up, and in the Dvar Torah, in order to make a point, I could say, you know, and the Buddha makes a very similar point to what Rabbi Akiva says, and no one about an eye, or at least in my crowds, they wouldn't. They maybe think it's interesting, and they'll see it as a valuable insight. I actually had a Sheva Brachos, in which all sorts of people were in attendance, big rabbis. I just came from my world religion class, and I spoke about the chassam. I spoke a little bit about Taoism, that reminds me of the philosophy of Taoism, that how you help everyone out without taking credit for yourself. And they might think it's strange, but no one's outraged if they see your point, because Yesh Chachma V'Goyim, there's wisdom among the nations. But if you would ever get up and cite something positive said by Jesus, the roof would fall off the shul. In fact, there was a rabbi in Frankfurt. He went to Nachemya Novo. He was a bit of eccentric character. We'll have classes on him. A brilliant man, died young. He once quoted a verse, I forget the exact words, but your Redeemer liveth, which is actually a verse from the Tanakh. But some guy got up and he thought he was quoting the New Testament and got up and walked out. We have that recorded in the memoir literature. But we have such a history with Christianity. First of all, Christianity is not like Buddhism. It's a Jewish heresy. It comes off from Judaism. So that's problem number one. So there's been so much persecution from Christians of Jews. We have passages in the Talmud. So basically, you can't say, you know, look at Jesus, he says some positive things. And Ben Amozig's not saying that to the Jews. However, he's saying to Palier that there are good things in Jesus. Pick those things, leave aside the divinity. Then he says, the future of the human race lies in this formula. If you come to convince yourself of it, you will be much more precious to Israel than if you submit to the law of Israel. You will be the instrument of the providence of God to humanity. He's telling Palier, you can fulfill God's providence and accomplish much more as a non-Jew. A Jew is not going to be able to influence the non-Jews to give up their belief in Josef's divinity and to follow the Noahide law. You, as a non-Jew, you can accomplish that. And he goes on and on. At this time, Palier was thinking about becoming a priest, and he wondered whether he could be a priest and believe in the Noahide law, because he was very attached to Catholicism. His mother was very pious. He still thought there was value in the sacraments, but he didn't take them literally, but he thought that there could be value, and he thought that maybe he could be a priest and preach without, you know, focusing on doctrine. You know, Jesus says, God, just focus on the moral message. You could do a lot, you know, and you could preach in churches and to people about to be good people and to help the poor and all these sorts of things. And Ben Amozig tells him he can't do it. He says, I cannot withhold from you that your duty shuts out the Catholic priesthood. He says, if your faith today were that of your childhood, who would dare turn you from it? But in your state of mind, what torture you will prepare for yourself? And what sacrilege if you preach beliefs that you know to be lies? He says to him, you don't believe this stuff. You know it's false, and therefore you have to give up the priesthood. You can't be the priesthood. You need to become a Noahite. One more little passage I'll share with you. So then how to live? That's the problem. He's a community of one. If he can't be a Christian and he can't be a Jew, how is he going to live? Because Jews, people need ritual. They need a religion. It's not enough just to, that's why these Noahides, it'll never get off and never be attractive for two reasons, actually. One is, the typical Noahide, if you become convinced about God's revelation, you're going to want to be Jewish. And secondly, even if immediately you don't want to be Noahidism, there's no ritual, there's no religion. It's just an abstention from doing things. That doesn't satisfy people intellectually, or spiritually, I should say. Now, why do I say you can't have rituals? Hopefully you could, I guess, develop rituals if you had community. Although that would require rejecting the Rambam. The Rambam has this viewpoint, which is a little strange, because he seems to extrapolate it from the fact that Noahides are not permitted to observe Shabbos, and he says that they can't do anything. Somewhere, Ravara Lichtenstein writes about how this is not shared by the other Rishonim, and it's hard to imagine. How can you have a community of non-Jews who literally can't do anything? That is, their whole life is just abstaining from sins, from idolatry and things like that, but not actually do anything. So you can never really have a community. Who's going to be part of a community where you can't do anything? Which is why Reviron's point was that you could do something, if I remember him correctly. But I found Rabbi Chait. He's Maimonideans. I'll get back to what you're saying in a second, Yisrael. There's this Rabbi Chait. He's a Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva in Far Rockaway. Unusual because they're very much opposed to mysticism, Kabbalah, Zohar. They're very into the Rambam, only the Rambam. So let me read you what he says and ask yourself while I'm reading it. Anyone want to be a Noahide? If this is what a Noahide meant? After explaining the Rambam's position that a Noahide can't actually do anything, can't create rituals, what does this mean for B'nai Noach practically and theoretically? We should note that while very few of the 613 commandments have made their way into the B'nai Noach system as mandatory, the above one did. The Ben Noach is not permitted to add to or create any religious ceremonies or rituals. While this is not part of the seven societal mandates, it is incumbent upon every Ben Noah. It is considered such a serious violation that it is punishable by death, not by a human corp, but by God himself. On a practical level, this means that a Ben Noah must avoid introducing any kind of ceremony or symbolic act, be it of a personal nature or related to institutions such as marriage, divorce, birth of a child, etc. Then he asks, does this mean that the Ben Noah can do nothing of a religious nature? Most certainly not. The Ben Noah can and should be actively involved in the study of Torah pertaining to him. He may, and in certain instances, must pray in accordance with the manner the Torah prescribes. He may voluntarily perform almost any mitzvah commandment. Then he says, as long as he receives instruction on it from the rabbis. But no rituals, no ceremonies. That would be very hard. Get married, you don't have a ritual ceremony, what would be wrong with it? The Rambam's position is so strange. Malki Tzedek was doing ritual ceremonies. We have other examples of people who we assume were worshipping the one God, even though they were not Jews, and they were doing ceremonies. So it is a difficult position. So what you're saying is that exactly saying they don't do rituals, and they don't do ceremonies. They can remember the Sabbath. I don't know if that means remember the Sabbath. Yeah, they can keep kosher, but they can't keep kosher. According to the Rambam, I don't think they can keep kosher if they're doing it for religious reasons. That would be hard. I don't know if today, though, everyone follows Rabbi Chait. He's a Maimonidean. I wonder if you ask these rabbis who advise the Noahides if they really hold of the Rambam's position in this, which is not mentioned by the other Rishonim. In any event, Ben Amozig doesn't have this position. He's not a Maimonidean in this. He says to him that you can be a Noahide and just do the basic things, abstain. Now, let me tell you something else. According to everyone else but the Rambam, it seems that you can be a good Noahide and be an atheist. Seven Noahide laws say nothing about believing in God. It says don't worship idols, but it doesn't say you have to have any positive belief. The Rambam, in Hilchos Malachim, speaks about you have to acknowledge the giving of the Torah, that sort of thing. But the others don't. He says as follows, Ben Amozig. However, if an outward bond be indispensable to you, if you cannot be content with that which the religion, Jewish religion offers you, that is, if it's not enough for you just to follow the Noahide rules, I'm greatly mistaken if you cannot find in the large number of Christian churches a church professing a liberty of faith concerning the Trinity and the Incarnation that may be reconcilable with the tradition that is the prototype of Israel. In other words, find a non-Trinitarian church. Go to the Unitarians. Unitarianism. There you acknowledge Jesus as a wise man, and that's all. And they have certain ceremonies. If you need ritual of a sort, you can go to the Unitarians. I also believe that concerning the observance of Mosaism, there would be conceded to the faithful the right of professing their thoughts and of practicing all that conscience dictates. Why should you not become a member of such a church? In other words, he's rejecting the Rambam here. And he says, in the path that I have indicated being the true way upon you, you will be in intimate communion with Israel, taking part, as you wish, in its worship and its ceremonies, and what is more, if you wish, even without renouncing Jesus. He then says that if you want, you can partake in Jewish ritual also, and you don't even have to reject Jesus. Let us understand one another well. On condition that you see in Jesus only a just man, a prophet, only a man, however lofty you wish to imagine him. And it will be easier for you to reconcile this with conceptions of Judaism, which you know were in the teachings of Jesus most sympathetic to the teachings. Who can tell if you are not destined to become the union of Christianity and Judaism? Non-Jews involving themselves in non-Jewish religion, involving themselves in Jewish religion, as together with the Noahide rules. Amazing. Yes, wow. I think that's just like you have Jubus. Jews, it's like the old joke that what Jewish cup is going to accept that Jesus is God. But the Unitarian, that's different, or even a Jewish Buddhist. Let me go on. Palyeh is so sympathetic to Judaism that he's even able to justify the negative views, Jewish views of Christians and of Christianity. any one of us who's grown up in the Jewish world has heard negative things about Christianity. In Eastern Europe, you'd have people who, when they passed a church, would spit at, bound to create ill will. Listen to what Paulier says. He's talking about how the Christians are anti-Semitic, they have negative feelings about Jews, and then he says, they picture the Jews of a village lost in the Carpathian Mountains spitting despitefully as they pass by the crucifixes that extend their great arms of pity over the sad country. And now he says about the non-Jews, they take the coarseness of the gesture and the imprecations and the curses which accompany it for the accurate and traditional expression of the sentiments of the entire synagogue, that is, the entire Jewish religion. The gesture may be authentic, and equally so the childish maledictions. But I dare to say that nothing of all of this is really meant for the person of Jesus himself, of whom these shut-ins and ignorant Jews have never known anything. It was the centuries of persecutions inflicted on their people in the name of the crucified one, which evoked against his image this unintelligent and shocking protest. Can one really refuse to forgive them when one considers the misery and the sorrows which form the course of their history because of the unworthy conduct of the followers of Jesus, ever forgetful of the most elementary lessons of the gospel? In other words, the Hasidic Jew who passes and spits or says negative things about the church, about Jesus or anything, Ben Amozek says, this Jew is ignorant. He doesn't know anything about Christianity. For him, Christianity is the evil non-Jew who, in the name of Jesus, persecuted them. He doesn't know about the pulpit sayings of Jesus, of love thy neighbor, and all the wonderful things Jesus taught. So don't blame this non-Jew. The Christianity he's spitting against is the one that has persecuted him for so long. Talk about having an open mind and a tolerant view. Paulier still sees the value of Jesus' teachings, even though the doctrine, the logical doctrine of Christianity, is in error. In other words, just like Unitarians argue, mainstream Christianity has distorted the message of Jesus. They've taken a wonderful teacher and they've turned him into a god. What could be more blasphemous than that? To take someone who has a lot of good things to say and turn him into a god, and then use this God-man as your goal to subjugate and persecute the rest of the world. So that's how Paulie. So why not convert, though? I read to you what Ben Amozek wrote to him, but throughout his life, Paulie still was under pressure. He wanted to convert. He wanted to be Jewish. And he writes again to Ben Amozek. And Ben Amozek tells him, once again, that he acknowledges that we have great teachers who are Jewish, who are converts. Shemaya and Avtalion are said to have been converts. And then Amozek says, maybe I should receive you like Shemaya and Avtalion were received. And it's more than that. Ben Amozek was already becoming a bit of a Talmud Chacham. He wants to become a rabbi. But Ben Amozek still pushes him off. And he says, there are two important reasons compel me to persist in the opinion that I have already expressed to you. The first is the desire to begin with you and in you this religious movement which will bring about the final evolution of Christianity. So you, Ben Amozek, saying you, Paulier, are the one that can help with this new movement. I think it's interesting to speculate whether maybe there's some selfishness here, that Ben Amozek so much wants this new movement to start of a Noahide tradition that he's almost sacrificing Paulier to do this. Although, that would only be, I think, if you adopt Zaini's perspective, that there's something less about being a non-Jew. Clearly, Ben Amozek thought that being a Noahide is the equivalent of being a Jew as long as you do your task. Someone makes a comment here that there's a parallel to Lubavitch in the sense that some of them would ascribe divinity to the Rebbe. That was obviously what I had in mind. Here you take one of the great Tzaddikim and the great Talmidei Chachamim, and forget about making him into a divinity. That's just idiotic and crazy. But you have people turn him into a messianic figure. Not enough, all the good he did, all that he accomplished, how he turned Judaism into something that anywhere you go, you find, assistance, you find the shulchim. I'm going to plan this wonderful trip to Europe next summer. I'm going to be in Bratislava for Shabbos. Who's in Bratislava? The Chabad rabbi. So I'm going to be with the Chabad rabbi. Yeah. That's the only one there. I've been to plenty of other places where the only game in town is the Chabad Rabbi. And there's, we could talk for hours about how much Chabad accomplished. So it's not enough to give all these chuyos to the Rebbe. Now you have to a messiah, a messianic figure, and then, of course, even become blasphemous, ascribe some sort of divinity to him. That's what Ben Amozek is saying about Jesus. And then he says, and this is even his second reason why he doesn't want Palye to convert. Look, if Palye would have come to him, as the old story goes, remember the medieval king who waited out in the snow for the Pope to forgive him? If Palye would have come and refused to leave until he converted him, then maybe he would have converted him. This is the second reason. It's the profound conviction that I have that in the new attitude that you would take, you could be much more helpful to Judaism than if you entered into its bosom. Yes, much more helpful from without than within. In other words, you will help Judaism more. You will show the non-Jews what Judaism is all about. So you'll help the non-Jews and you'll help the Jews. After Ben Amozek dies, Palye decides that, you know, maybe now they'll let me convert. This has been a Moses idea that I shouldn't convert, but now it's been many years. Maybe it's time for me to convert. He turns to the rabbi of Livorno who succeeded Ben Amozek. His name was Rabbi Colombo. Just like the television show Colombo. He starts it though with an O. C-O-L-O. I think Colombo is C-O-L-U. And he wants Rabbi Colombo to convert him. And he wants to be a rabbi. I don't know if he wanted to be a rabbi actually when I read you the section that Ben Amozek wrote to him, but by now he wants to be a rabbi. And Rabbi Colombo replies to him, what will Ben Amozek think? This question I think I can reply with my soul and conscience. That the great and venerated master would have been as firm now as before. That you can render the greatest, the most considerable service to the cause of Israel in not becoming Jewish. He says that as a non-Jew, you can do whatever religious activity you want. Because you're not that of an Israelite. You can make up your own sort of religion. Preach the message, etc., etc. That's what Rabbi Colombo says to him. Says that since you're outside Judaism, you can have much more influence. And then he says, listen to this. May I take the liberty to express to you an altogether personal opinion, perhaps mistaken, but I believe to be right. I would say to you that according to my way of thinking, if the most brilliant pulpit were offered to you as a rabbi, and you were prepared to occupy it in conforming to the multiplicity of obligations inherent in such a charge, you would not be able to do as much good as if resolved as you are to serve Judaism, you retained your entire independence. He says to him, you will do more for Judaism as a non-Jew, Noachai, than you were as a rabbi. Dear brother, for you that are to me in the full sense of the word, brother in humanity and in faith, brother in heart and thought, I am conscious of the unusual importance of the words that I address to you in advising you not to abandon the path pointed out to you by our revered master. And in so doing, I believe I remain a humble witness to truth. So he's turned down again now by Rabbi Colombo. He can't become Jewish, but something is still tugging at him. He wants to, he needs a connection. And he's not sure about the rituals. I mean, Rabbi Ben Amozek said you could do the rituals, but he apparently is not 100% sure exactly what he can do, what he can't do. Ben Amozek is no longer alive, so he can't ask him for details on this. So he says that he has a friend who he corresponds with in Hebrew, in Palestine. And this friend consented to ask the chief rabbi, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, he says, of Jerusalem, the same question that he had put to Rabbi Colombo. And he said that, you know, what can he do? How can he live as a Jew? He'd asked this question to Ben Amozek, but I get the sense that now Ben Amozek isn't here and maybe he wants to do more Jewish practices because when Ben Amozek was alive, he didn't wear tefillin, he didn't do these sorts of things, and now he wants to take another step. And without Ben Amozek here, he turns to Ben Amozek's successor, Colombo, and he turns to the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. I believe that would be Rav Shmuel Salant. Could be the Aderis, but I think it's Rav Shmuel Salant. And of course, notice the difference. Rabbi Colombo replies to him in the way that I read to you. It is an exalted, humanistic type of language. He says that the chief rabbi replied with a casuistic disquisition on the place that I could occupy in the synagogue. In other words, The chief rabbi sent a tshuva, a response to them, citing rabbinic literature, what he could do and what he can't do. What did the chief rabbi say? The chief rabbi told him what he could do in the synagogue, the way to comport myself, even how to wear the talit, and to express the Jewish rites as I saw best. And he says, upon seeing this letter from the chief rabbi, and also from, he says, this corroborated the advice I had previously received from Ben Amozid, proving that the latter had not given me a purely personal doctrine, unfounded on tradition. He was a little unsure. He was sure, well, is Ben Amozid really correct? He's telling me I can go to shul and wear a talis and everything. So when he gets the chief rabbi of Jerusalem telling him you can do the same thing, then he feels it's okay, and he acknowledges, although Ben Amozid is his Rebbe, he says, now I feel good in knowing that this wasn't just Ben Amozid's personal chiddush, his personal opinion, but the chief rabbi of Jerusalem also agrees. So here you have, just imagine, you have a non-Jew who's going to be going to shul on Shabbos wearing a talis. We had, in Second Temple days, you had these non-Jews, these like fellow travelers, who would go to synagogue and try to be involved with the Jewish community, but that's because they didn't want to, they were afraid of circumcision. So they really wanted to be Jews. They didn't have a consciousness that they were Noahides. They were Jews lacking circumcision. This was an era when the Greek and Roman type of mythology, these religions, were on the way out. People wanted more, and for a short period there, Judaism was very attractive to the intellectual class, the enlightened class. Then, of course, Christianity comes on the scene, and immediately it becomes a very popular religion. Judaism was harder. It has so many requirements. But had Christianity not come on the scene, Judaism would have, I assume, conquered Rome and become the national religion. But it's not meant to be, because we're not supposed to be the world religion. We're supposed to be a small people carrying on our way. Now, I mentioned this business about in shul and how he's supposed to carry himself out, because Zaini also, although he's a chassid of Ben Amozid, he doesn't know apparently this, because in his book, in his introduction, he has a long biographical introduction, and he mentions Pallier. But I assume he read the autobiography, but he probably forgot what appears there, because on page 52, he cites testimony from Rabbi Menachem Hartom. He was one of the rabbis in Italy, then goes later went on Aliyah. That Rabbi Hartom, after the Second World War, saw Pallier in shul on Shabbos with wearing a talis, and therefore Zaini says it appears we call him Nira Hitgayer Bishlav Kolshahu, that Pallier at one point in time must have converted. He says that he's, and he says, I'm going to speak about Pallier and his role in spreading the teachings of Ben Amozid in my Hebrew translation of the book Israel and Humanity I've been reading from. But he's wrong here. He never converted. Not at all. Many people knew him. To the end of his life, he remains a non-Jew. And the fact that Rabbi Hartom told Zaini, Rabbi Hartom's not alive anymore, but told Zaini that after the war he saw Pallier and shul with the talis, that's in accordance with the instruction of the chief rabbi of Jerusalem that he can go to shul and wear a talis. That's it. I see it's already 10. I have about 10 more minutes left I want to do. We will pick up next class. We will start next class after no more than 10, 15 minutes with Rabbi Yosef Nassas, return to Morocco. But there are a couple more things I quickly want to go through, which I know you will find great interest. So let me just conclude with this point. There's so much is now, as I told you, been written about Ben Amozig in the last 15 years. There's a whole following now of him. And yet, most people are unaware of what I'm going to show you. If you look, for example, in the Encyclopedia Judaica, they don't mention this book at all. If you go to the Harvard University catalog, they do mention it there. But in various biographies of him and discussions, they all refer to a book that we spoke about, Ein Mikra, the commentary on Torah, which we just saw a passage part of it. But he wrote another commentary on Torah that all these people who write about Ben Amozid don't know about. And that's because it's not listed under his name. Let me show you the title page. It looks like a Mikros Gedolos, oh, sorry. It looks like a Mikros Gedolos Chamesh. Here's the title page. Let me pull it up. There's a parish that appeared in Livorno in the 19th century called Svat Emet. You could see the publisher right here, Ben Amozig. Remember, he had a printing press. But if you look at most catalogs, not the Harvard catalog, look at the bottom. It's the Defusa Chadash, the new printing of Elio Ben Amozig and partners. If you look at all the catalogs, they just refer to this as a chumash. In fact, HebrewBooks.org, in the last update of a couple days ago, they put up 300 new books. They have this. This picture you're looking at now comes from HebrewBooks.org, and they don't, in all the books on the HebrewBooks.org, they have the title of the book and they have the author. They don't have they don't even call it Svat Emet Chumash. They just say Chamish Echom Shei Torah. So no one going to HebrewBooks.org, which has a number of Ben Amozig's books, would ever be able to find this thing. What is this Chumash? Well, it's a Chumash that Ben Amozig published. It contained the Perish of Sha'al Shech, which is a Kabbalistic Perish. Also the Chidah, Perish of Rabbi Chaim Yossi David Azulai, who himself was a friend of Israel. Was all over Italy, very important figure. And in addition, and Rashi has in there, and this is a nice chumash, a wonderful chumash to print out. You can order it on HebrewBooks.org and bring it to show on Shabbos. Let me show you what it looks like in the middle. So you get a sense of what it looks like. Enlarge it a little. So you have Targum and chumash on top. And this chumash and his other chumash also are intended for show. You know they're intended for show because they have an Haftorah in the back. So you have the Rashi, you have the Sifsei Chachamim, but at the bottom here you have, well on this page you don't have Al-Sheikh. Al-Sheikh is Perish, is Torah Moshe. But you have here Pnei David, that's the Chidah, and on the right hand side you have a Perish commentary called Panim LaTorah. Panim LaTorah is Ben Amozig's other Perish on Chumash. In this Mikras Kedolos Chumash, which he published, with these various commentaries in Livorno, he also included a commentary. So we have Ein LaMikra, which is the commentary that tries to cite all the non-Jewish sources and illuminate the Torah's laws. And this is a more of a traditional type of commentary, but as I said, very, very few people know about it. You already see it's going to be interesting, because just on this page, this is in Bereishis, right over here, I just noticed he's citing Ibn Ezra, the Ralbag, the Rambam, and the Mora. So I'm going to order, I'm going to print this out. Only one volume so far appears in the book. But there's probably gems. I've never gone through this Perish because I don't want to print it out. It's too many pages and it's hard to do it online. So I wait till I can actually print it out and bind it. But I am sure, like I said, there'll be gems here. And no one knows about this Perish. As I said, it's amazing that people write about Ben Amozig. They all write about the Ein LaMikra. They don't know about the Panim LaTorah. With that, we will end. I really thought we would finish Ben Amozig today, but he is a great figure, a wonderful figure, and we are not on any time frame here. As long as it takes, it takes. But we will get to Yosef Messas next class. So I will wait two or three more minutes if anyone has questions. And the stuff I want to share with you... about the new letters of Chaim Ozer Grozinski, a new book of Avram Shapiro, the sort of stuff that from correspondence with people, both of you who are listening here and people who don't listen live, I know it's the sort of stuff that all of you find just great, really great stuff. Try to get to that if we can this semester. There now is a link online on the Torah in Motion homepage for the summer trip. They don't have the prices yet. That should be up soon, but you have the dates. So if you are even considering perhaps coming with us and the choice of this or another trip, you need to know what the dates are. The dates are there, July 21st, 31st. God willing, I will be there next month trying to get the most out of the way and interesting things that you won't get on the normal tours. So, a lot to say. Okay, I see some people writing. You are correct, Yisrael. The Rambam says that if someone comes to convert and we see they're sincere, we're supposed to convert them immediately. And if you look in the Rambam, there's no conversion classes, there's no waiting a year and all that. It's a pretty fast thing. That's why I say that if Poirier really insisted he wanted to convert, then Amozig would have had to convert him. And Amozig was able to convince him that he shouldn't convert. If after all of his convincing, Poirier said, nevertheless, I still want to convert, then Ben Amozig would have had no choice. You know, there's another passage. There's one I didn't read to you. I should read to you now. The third person he wrote to was a rabbi named Benno Yaakov. Some of you heard him. He was not an Orthodox rabbi. I wouldn't call him a reform rabbi. He was more of like a conservative rabbi in Germany. He's well known for his attacks on Bellhausen, the documentary Hypothesis. But he's one of the rabbis that he wrote to, also about converting. And what does Ben Amozig say to him? He wrote to him after Rabbi Colombo said that it's better not to be a rabbi. You'd do better if you were a non-Jew. This is what Benno Yaakov says to him. He says, becoming a rabbi would be the least effective. We would have one Jew and one rabbi the more. And he's saying, basically, big deal. One more rabbi coming to join the little phalanx of those who here and there preach to a dozen Israelites on the superiority of Judaism and its universal mission without ever having ever converted a single soul to their doctrines. So Benno Yaakov didn't have much faith in the ability of rabbis, but he's saying to him, you could accomplish much more. So what Ben Amozig is saying, Yisrael, is that at the end of the day, we're trying to serve God. You're trying to serve God. If you think that the only way to serve God is to be a Jew, you're wrong. And if you think that the best way to serve God is to be a Jew, let me tell you why it's not. Because you could actually serve God much better by bringing God's religion to the non-Jews, by showing them that you can live as a non-Jew and still be part of God's religion. That if after hearing all this, then Poirier was still not convinced, and he would have had to convert him, but he convinced him. And Poirier became the first Noahide in history, at least the first Noahide. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Well, Barak, the question is, who is the Jesus in the Talmud? The assumption is, people like Yaakov Emden and others, is that this is not Jesus of Nazareth. Is Jesus, that's what I'm assuming Yaakov Emden's assumption is. Others say it explicitly, including the Yechiel of Paris, that the Jesus in the Talmud is a different person, not Jesus of Nazareth. It could be that Yaakov Emden, even if he didn't hold that, could have said that the viewpoint of the Gemara is in order to act Christians because of what Jesus has become. But it's not really a historical statement, it's more of a Gothic statement. Now, how could they say he's not the Jesus of Nazareth? It certainly is the Jesus of Nazareth. But even the Ramban, you can see from the Ramban what the problem was in his Vikuach. If you look at where the Talmud places Jesus, they place him before Jesus of Nazareth. They place him like 150 years before, because look at the teachers he has. Those don't correspond chronologically to Jesus of Nazareth. I think the answer is that the Talmud, some of your teachers are confused about when he lived. I don't think there's any question that it's Jesus of Nazareth. But the fact that the genealogy isn't correct, that the people he is supposed to be involved with, Yoshua ben Parachia, when he's supposed to have lived, that enables them to say it's a different Jesus of Nazareth. I always assume this is just apologetics, that they don't really believe this. And I still think they probably don't believe it, at least most of them. But Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, actually, I had my friend Rav Asher Lepatin ask Rav Aaron about a different thing, and Rav Aaron really believed that the Jesus described in the Talmud is not Jesus of Nazareth, and I find it almost incomprehensible. I'm certain that everyone who says this, including the first one who says this, which is Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, they don't mean it literally. Now the Ramban, he knows the genealogical problem, and therefore look at the beginning of his Vikuach. Therefore, he assumes that the Christians have it wrong, and that the Christians are off 150 or so years because Jesus really lived, 150 BC, whatever. So the genealogy is a difficult thing. We spoke in the class on Chuck, you heard my class, which they're going to be sending out also as video on Torah study on Christmas Eve. They should send it out soon, getting up to the Christmas season. A number of you were on with me last year. In there, I discuss Peter Schaefer from Princeton, his book that came out a couple of years ago on how Jesus is portrayed in the Talmud. In my next Sfarim blog post, which I hope, I don't know if it'll be out next week, maybe the week after, I briefly refer to Toldos Yeshu. There is a work that goes back to the Chazal, which are legends and stories about Jesus, very derogatory stuff. Including Jesus got the shame on the farash, and he flew, and he's flying up in the air, and you know how they got him down? They got him down because another rabbi also had the guy's holy name, and he flew up, and he flew on top of him and urinated on him. And that made him tamei, and therefore he crash-landed. I mean, all sorts of crazy, crazy stories. Jews could not attack Christians physically, and they couldn't defend themselves from their attacks. Therefore, they attacked them by the book. And Jewish literature is full of crude and even sometimes disgusting stuff said about Jesus. Okay, well then, thank you very much, everyone. This was the fourth class, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes, so we have 4 more to go, and next week we'll be finishing up Ben Amozig and picking right up into Joseph Mesa. So I'll wait up one more second. I see Barak is typing something. Okay, thank you very much. Good night, everyone.